Welcome to Inside Scoop Live. Hi, I'm Irene Watson. I'm your host for today. I'm really delighted to be speaking on the phone with Henry Mascara. He is the author of Sleepers Run. Henry is a writer and artist born and raised in Caracas, Venezuela. He attends the University of Miami, Florida, where he obtained a double major in graphic design and film. As a writer, he enjoys researching his novels extensively, including gaining firsthand knowledge of some of his characters' skills. He currently resides in Los Angeles with his wife, dog, and cat. Sleepers Run is his first novel. And as I've mentioned, Henry did a lot of research when writing his book, and most of it was hands-on, and that's what we're going to be talking about today. He did things like urban survival training, he took flying lessons, and he took weapons training. And so stay tuned, because he's going to be telling us a lot about things that he experienced. Hi, Henry.
Hi.
Well, I'm sure glad to be talking to you. And in your book, Sleepers Run, you've done a lot of research. So I want to talk a little bit about some of the research that you have done, and particularly urban survival training.
Yeah, that was actually very interesting. I think you can divide the research in two. The one that was purely academic, and I was sitting down and, you know, reading a bunch of books and trying to assimilate as much as I could. And then there was the active research, in which I, for whatever reason, I just wanted to experience some of the things a character would in real life to understand either, well, actually both, the mechanics and the psychology that takes to do some of the things that these people do.
Well, tell me what you did.
Well, the one that you mentioned, urban survival, I think was one of the most interesting ones, because it's so, you know, far away from what I, at least, have experienced in my life, that I think that's the one that fascinates people the most.
Yeah, and so I want you to tell me what was some of the training that you did?
Very interesting things, like things from either stress management, for example, to things a little bit more esoteric, of how to blend in with an urban environment, how to disappear in a crowd, how to read, you know, a crowd, how to open locks and things of the nature. So I spent 3 days going through this class in the middle of nowhere in outside of Vegas in Nevada. And our final test was actually, with what we have learned, we'll spend the whole day running around the outside area of Las Vegas, and then we end up in the Strip. And we had to do this while we have a team of trackers chasing after us. So we had to use all our little tricks in order to make this happen.
Oh, how interesting. And so tell me, you said the blending in to the crowd, and how would you do that?
You know, you observe, you know, for example, a neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Every neighborhood, every place has its own rhythm and its own makeup. So, you know, if you go, say, to a middle-class neighborhood, there are some certain things that sort of blend in. They don't come out of place. Say, if you're driving a Mercedes in the middle of this neighborhood, you might stand out. But if you drive, you know, a Hyundai, maybe, you're not going to be. So, you know, you start, one of the things I teach is that, to actually see what's natural to that environment, and then you try to blend in into that environment, the way you dress, the way you act, the way you move around, you know, it's very different. Then I open in experience, because now, I mean, I'm a weekend warrior. I don't do this for a living. But you come out, you go out, and you start seeing things, a little bit different things.
Yeah, I bet you do. I bet you do. And what a great experience to learn all these things. And but you also did other things like flying lessons?
Yes. That was probably the most frightening one.
Oh, I bet. No grounding there.
Yeah, early on I knew I wanted to do something that had to do with flying.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, okay, well, you know, I'll go to a local airport, take a few flying lessons, and see how this whole flying thing is.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, the premise seemed simple enough and harmless enough. Then you get into this little airplane. And
with only one engine?
Only one engine.
Uh-huh.
I have a very experienced instructor next to me. And then you take off. And, you know, if you think turbulence is bad when you're in a big airplane, I mean, in a little airplane, you feel everything.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like flying in a handbasket. And it was very, it's beautiful. I mean, for example, I live in Los Angeles, so, you know, flying over the coast of California and the mountains is very beautiful. But it's not a simple thing to do. It requires a lot of focus, a lot of attention, attention to detail, too, and a lot of preparation. I mean, it's incredible the amount of preparation that it takes before and after you fly an airplane. And these are things I have absolutely no idea about. And you know, it was very interesting to learn all of this.
Oh, so you mean you just don't go get in the plane and take off?
No, it's not like
oh.
Actually, flying the plane, it's not the hardest part. The navigation part, of course, is
uh-huh.
not, it's actually complicated. But flying the airplane, you know, it's very easy. It's probably easier than driving a car.
Really?
Yeah, but the mechanics of it. It's not that complicated. But everything else that you have to keep in mind, the communications with ground control and the control tower and which are two different things I found out, those are the things that are really fascinating, you know, things that you have to keep in mind all the time, your bearing, how high are you going, how fast are you going, wing speed, I mean, things that you wouldn't even think about. So,
did you ever get over your fear?
You know, I actually think I was enjoying it, but my instructor didn't have a lot of patience.
Oh, no.
And I made a mistake once on a takeoff.
Yeah?
He wasn't very happy with it, and he let me know in so many words. He just scared, you know, the life out of me.
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember I was so shaken that when we finished that lesson, I mean, I was sweating throughout the whole lesson after that.
I bet.
It took me forever to calm down. I was so rattled by, you know, because he was really, you know, mad. He
mm-hmm.
was not a happy camper. So, and then, of course, he calmed down and said, well, you know, you know, it wasn't that bad. I just kind of overreacted. But he already scared me. So
yeah.
It was one of those things that I said, you know what, next week I have to show up and do it again. I can't, you know, I have to get back on the horse. I can't just go, you know, let this be the last experience I had. And I did it a few more times, and, you know, it helped. But, you know, that part, I mean, that really, that wasn't fun. I said, hey, man, I'm new at this. You need to relax and
don't
have a little fish.
So, Henry, do you find that after taking flying lessons in a small plane like that and understanding and going through, you know, turbulence, I've been in small planes, and I know that you feel everything. Are you now, when you fly on larger commercial planes, do you have a different perception?
Sure.
Understanding, yeah?
Now I know what they go through. I mean,
mm-hmm,
every,
mm-hmm.
I just came back from a trip, and it was, you know, when they're taxiing, you know, into the runway, of course, I'm not a pilot, you know, I don't understand absolutely everything,
right.
but I have an idea, okay, they're doing this, and now they're going to do that, and
mm-hmm.
at this point, the pilot must be doing this, and same thing when they're about to land.
Yeah.
You know, all of these little turns and things that they do, now they have meaning. It's like, okay, he's doing this because he's falling into the flying pattern that you
mm-hmm.
have to do around the airport. And so it does, I mean, all of this research, even though it was done for a book, it's actually personally edificating. I mean, it really, you know, it's something that you really come out a little bit better, a little bit different after going through them.
Of course. And, you know, your knowledge is different and your experience. And the other thing that I understand in your firsthand research was you also took some weapons training.
Yes. Go ahead.
I was just going to ask, what type of weapons were you training on?
Oh, handguns and knives.
Uh-huh.
That's what I was using. I have a long history with martial arts myself, but I never, it was always empty-hand martial
uh-huh.
arts.
I've
never, well, not never, but my experience with weapons is very small. So I needed to understand that I wasn't a gun person. You know, I've gone to a shooting range maybe a handful of times, and I had no idea what I was doing, really. So I needed to understand these things from, you know, quote unquote, a professional point of view. I would take, you know, hand defense classes, you know, handgun defense classes, and, you know, learn how to actually operate a gun as if it was a martial art itself, which it is.
Yeah.
You know, there is a whole dogma and procedure that you have to follow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how to do it safely and how to, you know, you need to know what you're doing. I mean, this is a very dangerous thing. And again, that was something that was completely out of the scope of my experience that it also informed me. And also watching a lot of these people, you know, I got to see and talk and pick the brains of the people who were teaching me these things. And, you know, these people have taught the military and federal law enforcement and special operations people. So, you know, they were a wealth of information for me.
Oh, I can well imagine.
And, you know, seeing their demeanor, seeing how they handle themselves, how they handle their guns, you know, because, you know, I don't have that experience, so I try to absorb it from them.
Mm-hmm.
And
so when you did your knife training, was this what was the purpose of training with knives? Is it for throwing or for actual combat?
Yeah, this is close-quarter combat with a knife.
Mm-hmm.
But I had to make a separation here. What I learned is what they teach, actually, and this is true for everything that I was learning, is what they teach civilian people. So it's a watered-down version of what, say, someone in the military will get.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, for example, as a civilian, you don't have the need to really kill anyone.
Right.
You have a right and a need to defend yourself. So the approach is a little bit different. With a knife, was all about how to get away safely in a self-defense situation,
mm-hmm.
meaning you're not going to kill the other person, but you will incapacitate them so you can run away and,
right.
you know, call the police and seek help. So it was great because it does teach you. I mean, fighting with a knife in the movies looks like, you know, like a fun thing to do.
Right.
You know, a guy grabs a knife, there's five people, and, you know, he just goes through them. And,
uh-huh.
Right. In real life, or at least when you put it into a real situation, even though it's a training situation, it's a messy business. I mean, you really have to have commitment to, one, pull a knife and, you know, to be so close to someone that you're going to hurt them with a knife. I mean, it changes really the perspective of what it is to have a blade in your hand. And it's a messy business, too, because it's not a one strike thing. It takes, you know, many strikes. For example, the Filipino martial arts systems, you know, different names, but are also basically the same system. They have probably the most highly evolved knife fighting techniques in the martial arts. And when you see what they do, I've been exposed to that a little bit, it's multiple strikes. It's never one strike. So you're always disabling and killing someone in a way.
Uh-huh.
So on this one in particular, it was interesting because I had to actually ask my instructor, okay, if you were to kill someone,
mm-hmm.
how do you actually go around and do this? And, you know, of course, I will tell him that I was writing a book. And
right.
My character is proficient at this. And I said, how do you go around doing this? And he said, okay, well, tell me the situation, and I'll tell you, you know, what would be realistic to do. And so I will, you know, tell him pretty much what I have in the book. And he'll go, okay, well, no, that's not going to happen. This is not going to be useful, but you can do this and this and that. And he will show me. And I was like, oh, great.
Wow.
So, but that was an aside. He wasn't teaching that, but
right.
I made it my sort of my duty every time to come up with these little scenarios and say, okay, how will you approach this if you were in this situation? And that was priceless to me.
Well, yeah, I can well imagine that. And as I'm listening, it's like, you know, I have never talked to another author that has done so much personal research as you have. You actually took your survival training. You took flying lessons. You took weapons lessons. to be able to understand what your characters do in the book. I mean, this is incredible. As I say, I've talked to authors that have done research, but not so intense. I'm very impressed.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Inside Scoop Live is a global internet-based broadcast specializing in interviewing published authors about their current books and areas of expertise. Join us and hear both well-known and upcoming writers talking candidly about their life experience as well as the business of being an author in today's literary world. Always interesting and current, we strive to bring our audience high-quality discussions that spotlight a vast diversity of authors in the field today. Our interviews are available 24/7 through Direct Podcast as well as MP3 download for your convenience. Please visit us on InsideScoopLive.com. Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. Today I'm talking with Henry Mascara, author of Sleepers Run. As you've heard so far, Henry is a very interesting author, and his experience is something many of us would like to have, at least I would. So stay tuned because there's just so much more to come. Now, Henry, you're originally from Venezuela, and when did you move to the United States?
Ooh, that was back in 1995.
Okay, and so did you go back to Venezuela to do some more research for your book? Because I understand your character goes to Venezuela.
Yes, well, he is half Venezuelan. He's half American, half Venezuelan. And no, I didn't go back. I lived there for 20 years. I was born and raised there. And part of the story was about a character who I call it Stranger in a Known Land. I mean, a character that was part of something, has been away. Now he comes back, is completely different, yet somehow familiar, and he tries to make sense of it. So a lot of what Eric, the main character, goes through is probably a lot of what I go through myself, watching from the outside my own country. So that really just seeped into what I was writing.
I wondered about that, Henry, if that is something that, as you were, you know, reflecting back, when you were living in Venezuela, and if you were able to bring that characterization into the plot from your memory, and also from observing what is going on there now.
Well, the country that I grew up with is a very different country that it is now. You know, all of these things have been going on, and this whole revolution or whatever they want to call it that's going down there, that's completely new to me. I mean, the gentleman who is the president right now of the country, the guy that I knew was a military guy who attempted a coup. And he went to prison, and that's all I knew. You know, that was it. I left the country, and then, you know, he's a political candidate. And I go, oh, really? Wow.
Yeah.
you know, life changes.
Yes.
I've never been there under the situation that it is right now. I don't have any more family or friends living there. I haven't been there. 1998 was the last time I went to visit. Again, he wasn't the president even back then. And I hear, of course, stories, you know, of what's going on. I still know people, you know, who you know, have friends or whatever who are from there, and they tell you all these stories. But I find it very interesting because I'm not one to trust what the media says. But it's kind of hard for me to make up my mind of what's going on. Because, you know, from one side you hear all these horrible stories, and then on another side, you hear another side saying, oh, you know, well, you know, things are better. And I go, really? Okay. So part of my research was to see both sides of the same equation and try to not really take a side, but just to present it as it is, which was, you know, it was tough.
Sure.
But it's okay. I don't want to alienate anyone. I want to actually bring everybody to the table on this issue and just try to just present facts, as, you know, as many facts as you can present in a fiction book. But so that was very important to me, you know, because even though, again, it is a work of fiction, I based my research on nonfiction sources. So.
Well, and that was what makes a good fiction book, that is for sure. So now your main character also suffers from PTSD. And did you actually do some research into post-traumatic stress disorder?
I did, and I formally talked to people about this. I mean, it's kind of hard to, maybe because it's my first book, I don't, you know, I didn't feel like going to someone and say, well, so I'm writing this book, you know, tell me, you know, tell me what happened to you, because, you know, I think these are very personal things, and
yeah.
I didn't want to, you know, trivialize them or treat them like, you know, just another part of the research. I didn't want to be cold about it.
Mm-hmm.
But I've known people who had it. No, they don't have it anymore, but who had it and who had gone through it. And I use sort of their stories in a way to inform, you know, how Eric will deal with post-traumatic stress disorder. But the other thing that really sort of endeared me to do this was how little it is spoken in the media or anywhere about the, you know, this is a huge problem. I mean, since, well, this is a different circumstances, right? But since the Vietnam War,
mm-hmm.
we haven't really talked much about it.
That's right.
And, but this is a whole different world. I mean, back then, they were all draftees. This is now a volunteer army.
Yeah.
So you have a whole generation of young American soldiers who have been fighting essentially two wars for about 10 years and who are coming back from these experiences. And we're talking about multiple deployments. We're talking about stop-loss policies. We're talking about people who, I'm sorry, have extended the term of service too. I mean, like, they have forced them to deploy again. It's a very different proposition from just being a draftee, not to diminish what they went through.
Right,
but,
of course.
You know, serving your tour of duty, seeing all these horrible things, coming back home, but, you know, at least then they send someone else. You know, it's not you four different, you know, four times in a row or something like that. And, you know, I just watched a documentary on TV about a few days ago. I think it was called Soldiers in Prison. That dealt about that, and it was the first time I actually saw something out there talking about this, and, you know, showing how, you know, you have all these suicides, and you have all of these people going to prison because of this, because, you know, they have a flashback or they have an episode in which, you know, their post-traumatic stress disorder kicks in, and some of these people are dangerous people, not because they're dangerous themselves, but the training they have undergone, it makes them, you know, pretty lethal people. You know, it's funny to me, or not funny, interesting, how the military teaches people how to fight, you know, how to essentially kill, but they don't teach them how to come back to society. You know, they, you know, once they're done with them, you know, well, that's it. You know, you go back to, you know, whatever life you can make for yourself. David Morrell's First Blood, I think, it's a, you know, a book that deals with that. You know, having this one guy, Rambo, who the guy from the book is very different from the guy in the movie. You know, who goes, fights, learns all these, you know, lethal techniques, and then, well, you know, see you later. Thank you.
Yeah. And, you know, 9/11, after 9/11, there was a lot of PTSD also that emerged. I had a friend that actually came out of the subway,
mm-hmm.
And he worked right there, right close to the Twin buildings, Twin Towers, and he came out of the subway just as the second plane was hitting. And he immediately turned around and started running. And, you know, he was just never the same. And several years later, he did commit suicide. It was just something that, you know, just really triggered him. And he had PTSD. And
yeah, it's not only related to the military.
Exactly. Sure. There's just so many things that could cause that. So, Henry, you have a dog and a cat.
Yes, I do.
Yeah, tell me about them. I'm a cat and dog lover, too, so.
Well, they are my office partners. They're the ones that, you know, sort of remind me that I have a life away from the keyboard. You know, when they come and they tell me, hey, you know, we need treats, we need to walk, we need to, you know, we need to do something other than watch you sitting here typing.
Uh-huh. You really get that when that cat jumps up on your desk and walks across the keyboard and lays down on your desk upside down, right?
Yes. She's the best saboteur of them all.
Yeah.
You know, waltz on the keyboard, so, you know, I have these garbled words on whatever I'm writing. She sits on whatever book I have open in front of me.
Uh-huh.
She knocks down everything that is around me. Yeah, she's great at doing that. And my dog is great at doing guilt trips, you know, sitting there and sighing and looking at me like, come on, let's go, let's do it.
It's my turn.
You know, you've been sitting here the whole day, come on.
Yeah.
So, you know, he brings me toys and, you know, like, okay, it's playtime now. And they don't take no for an answer.
They don't. Now, no is not actually part of the vocabulary when it comes to things like that. That is for sure. So, gosh, Henry, this has been really an interesting interview, and you've really inspired me with all your research. And actually, as I mentioned before, you know, just going out there and doing the training, it really hands-on experience. I mean, that is just I marvel at that. So. But let's tell our listening audience your website address.
Oh, they can find me at www.sleepersrun, that is separated by a hyphen, .com.
All right.
And that's my blog that, you know, they can find places where they can actually buy my book.
Mm-hmm.
They can see the trailer. You know, there's a whole...
The whole thing
there, and they can also link from there to either Facebook or Twitter when I post news and updates.
Great. So there you go, listeners. It's sleepers-run.
Yeah.
.com.
Mm-hmm.
And listeners, the name of the book is Sleepers Run, and we've been talking to Henry Mascara. And as if you've heard so far, this has been really interesting. And I encourage you to read the book. Our reviewer really liked it. And now after talking to Henry, I'm understanding why. Because, you know, as we talked in this interview, Henry actually went out and learned how his character is going to act and react. And, you know, this is just, it. As I mentioned, I marvel at that. So, Henry, thank you so much.
No, thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
This has been really great. And again, listeners, the book title is Sleepers Run, and the author is Henry Mascara. And this is Inside Scoop Live, Irene Watson, your host. Thanks for listening. Come again. Bye for now.